Well, I suppose the obvious question is, why should socialists in 2010 bother talking about Nick Kelly at all? And I suppose part of the answer is given by the former Victorian Police Commissioner, Neil Comrie, who summed up the attitude of respectable opinion to Kelly when he complained, "I've always found it disturbing that our community gives hero status to a person who was executed for the murder of three police officers." Now, someone who continues to so outrage respectable middle-class opinion, you know, well over 100 years after he was executed, you know, he was hung on the 11th of November 1880, and a lot of bad things happened in Australia on November the 11th, you know, 130 years ago, well, that's worth talking about as a phenomenon in and of itself. He must have had something going for him. Moreover, the popular legend of Ned Kelly, you know, the Robin Hood figure, you know, who is driven into outlaw status by corrupt police, you know, who fought in super all odds, who was the hero standing up for his downtrodden people, you know, the champion of the rural poor, exploited by the wealthy squatters. This is easily the most long-lasting legend in Australian history. We see the situation where the first feature film ever made, the 1906 film, The Story of the Kelly Gang, was about Ned Kelly. And since then, we've been treated to the spectacle of having everybody from Mick Jagger to Heath Ledger play Ned on the silver screen. And Peter Carey's more recent novel, The True History of the Kelly Gang, was a runaway bestseller. So Kelly is a phenomena. And the ability of the Kelly legend to sustain itself for so long period of time actually tells you as much about Ned Kelly, well, in ways tells you more about society today even than Kelly himself. And the part of the purpose of this talk is to examine actually how the real Ned, who was, you know, executed so long ago, stood up to this legend, how much truth in it is. But also I want to argue that the Robin Hood figure, the image of Ned Kelly, the myth, in many ways, is just as important to actually what the real historical character did. Yeah, because the myth tells you much about the nature of the class society we live in and what masses of people look to save them. Okay, now, a bit of personal background on these. When I can claim personally to be a member of the Kelly Gang, at my Catholic primary school in the 1950s, and so on, I was a member of a Kelly Gang headed by my two best friends. We were about 8 or 9, Joseph and Anthony Kelly, who claimed to be descendants of the figure. Now, whether this was, I presume everybody with the surname Kelly in Australia claimed some connection. Anyhow, but in those days, the image, the rebel status associated with Kelly was very much tied into the Irish. You know, it was up there with, you know, Peter Lawler, the great, you know, Irish leader of the Eureka Stockade. It was up there with the Irish martyrs, the convicts who were hung in 1804 for leading the Castle Hill revolt just outside Sydney, you know, who were, you know, the history of brutality of the convict system at Castle Hill. You know, the leaders of the revolt were left hung tree by tree for miles down the road, you know, and left there until they were rotten and eaten by the birds. And so that was the resonance of Kelly in particular. But really, the legends lived on well since then. And clearly today, the mass of people that identify in some way or other with the Kelly legend, really, the mass of those people know nothing about the oppression of the Irish or any particular identification with it. Kelly has come to signify something much broader, a symbol of defiance, of the poor standing up against the rich, of the rebel resolute to the bitter end. Now, mainstream opinion, to a certain point, have tried to co-opt elements of the Kali legend, into the images of Australian nationalism broadly. Tried to make, oh well, it's a bit like, the diggers dying at Gallipoli and so on, and to try to present Kelly as some sort of Australian nationalist or patriot. I mean, something Kelly himself would have found absolutely bizarre, because essentially the concept of being Australian didn't even exist at the time, let alone Kelly identifying as being an Australian, God's sake. But it has to be said, this attempt by bourgeois opinion to, co-opt the Kelly legend has only been successful up to a point. Because it has always been difficult to turn somebody whose greatest fame was shooting down police into a patriotic hero. And we have to say, the core of the appeal of Kelly remains the same. The image of the rebel, and appeal that is spread far and wide in Australia. It's quite significant, for example, that in the Northern Territory, Aborigines have identified with the Kelly legend for over 100 years. They were told, and the legend, how it actually got into the Northern Territory, people can't explain exactly, but there's an image of Kelly was that there was this person in the south, somewhere far away, who shot down police. In other words, the same people that were persecuting, murdering the Aborigine. There was some hero far away who shot these people down. And Kelly very much lived on in the Northern Territory amongst Aboriginal people. And indeed, the appeal of the Robin Hood figure goes down through the ages, actually for thousands of years. Ever since there's been a class society, and ever since there's been the exploitation and oppression that goes with class society. Because the reality is, for thousands of years, those at the bottom of society, the poor, the oppressed, most of the time they feel powerless. They feel unable to resist the tyranny of the rich. Most of the time they don't fight back. They are forced to submit. They feel helpless and ashamed of their own cowardice for not standing up. And this leads them, in a whole series of historical occasions, actually to glorify those who defy the norms of society. The hero of the poor is the strong, assertive one, drawn from their own ranks, who is unwilling to accept what society imposes on the oppressed, and that poverty and meekness. And this appeal was particularly strong in pre-capitalist societies, where there was, on the one hand, terrible oppression, and yet, on the other hand, it was difficult to organise resistance. There were no trade unions or the like. And in peasant societies, and in early capitalist societies, or even capitalist societies today, where there is not a strong working class movement, actually, bandits became quite a common social phenomenon. They were a primitive form of organised social protest. And this was reflected. This reflected the fact, as the great Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci wrote, of the southern Italian peasantry in the 1930s. They are in perpetual ferment, but as a mass incapable of providing a centralised expression for their aspirations and their needs. So they sought outlets in primitive forms of rebellion and honoured those amongst their ranks who would come forward and stand up and take on the rich and powerful. And it is only with the emergence of modern capitalist societies, the emergence of socialist parties and trade unions and so on, that this sort of anarchic rebellion, the rebel, the defier of authority and so on, actually starts to be subsumed. And the reality is, in peasant societies, the Robin Hood figures, you know, the revengers of the poor, who impose harsh justice on the rich, who fight but not surrender, often take on a directly political coloration. So, for example, in pre-World War I Italy, a famous Calabrian bandit made regular donations to the Italian Socialist Party. Another Italian bandit, whenever he entered a village, he'd confiscate the local grain stores and start distributing to the poor. He would impose a maximum on prices, which wheat could be sold in the village. And so it should come as no surprise then, after he was assassinated by the police, actually the villagers attempted to name the main street of the village after him. And we have a similar pattern in Australian history. You know, the first bushrangers were escaped convicts, and they were able to win wide support, not just amongst their fellow convicts, but from the mass of the free population, and particularly because large sections of the free population in Australia and, you know, in the 1810s, 1820s, 1830s were themselves people that had been brought to Australia in chains. And this sympathy for these rebels, you know, is reflected in a whole series of ways, by word of mouth, in all sorts of cultural forms and songs and legends and so on. You know, the bushrangers became the daring heroes, bold, larger-than-life characters, figures who stand up to authority, who do or die was their image. And the typical content was reflected in a whole variety of songs, the most famous being The Wild Colonial Boy, which is a chorus, and I won't, you know, shock you by my singing voice, but it's where the chorus goes, "Come all my hearties, we'll roam the mountains high. Together we will plunder, together we will die. We'll wander over valleys and gallop over plains, and we'll scorn to live in slavery, bound down with iron chains." And when, you know, as the song goes on, at the end, surrounded by police, the bushranger hero, Jack Doolan, lives up to his word, his cry of "fight but not surrender," and fights it out and is shot down by police in his heroic last stand. And that's continually the image. You know, in my own family, after Ned Kelly, the most famous bushranger in Australia was Ben Hall, in New South Wales fame. And my great-great-grandparents in outback New South Wales had a shanty pub and that. And the most famous thing that in their mind that ever happened to them, that the a rich squatter was taking horses to the races and stabled them there for a while, and Ben Paul's gang raided them and shot it out, stole the horses and got away. And this was, for generations through my family, the greatest sort of pride. You know, the bushrangers came there and shot it out and drove off the police and so on. This was fantastic, you know, oh, there was bullets going everywhere, but it was fantastic, you know. He was a hero and so on. The police, what trash they were. Okay. Now, the Kelly outbreak of bushranging in northeastern Victoria was the last great surge of bushranging in Australia, and lasted for a mere two short years, from 1878 to 1880. And though it has to be said that in many ways, you know, the Kellys were transitory figures between bushranging as it had been and new forms of resistance and they were transitory figures in a sense, in another sense, that they developed more of an organised social base than previous bushrangers. The Kelly outbreak grew out of a growing economic and social crisis in northeastern Victoria in the 1880s. You've got to remember, these were turbulent times politically and socially, with growing class tensions between the small farmers, the so-called selectors, and the big wealthy graziers, the squatters. The time was just 20 years after the armed uprising by miners at Eureka Stockade, a struggle that had won democracy in Australia and the right to vote. But in those 20 years, in terms of the gains, they were very of that revolt, were being very much whittled away in terms of the mass of the population. The legislation which had been pushed through to break up the land, to give land to small selectors, was being totally subverted by the rich and powerful. And the 1870s were a period of rapid growth of the cities in Australia and the spread of the railways into the rural areas. And the railways led to a concentration of trade in Melbourne and to the rise of a political power in Melbourne of the rich merchant class. And it was those who had capital that benefited from the rise of the railways. Those who had capital were able to make use of the growing, I'm talking about rural farmers and so on. Those who have capital were able to take advantage of the railway system and build up and the Melbourne market and gain from it. Whereas the small selectors and that who didn't have capital, they were being delivered into destitution. They were forced to live in virtual humpies in the northeast and so on, and their children were being driven off the land. Of these small farmers were turning into a new rural working class of landless labourers. And the arrival of the railways accelerated these trends and intensified them. And their response of this new and growing rural poor was a primitive anarchic type of rebellion. And that reflected in the stealing of stock, the burning down of the fences of the squatters, physical attacks on squatters, growing conflicts with police who are being sent in, of course, to defend property, and an increasing hostility to all government authority. After one cash with police, Ned Kelly's father was imprisoned and jailed and died in prison from the harsh conditions. And it was episodes like this, the generalised hatred of the police. And by the late 1870s, there was a virtual land war between squatters and selectors. Now, reinforcing these growing class tensions and struggles was the fact that a significant proportion of the rural poor, the landless labourers and so on, were of Irish extraction. And that applied to the Kellys themselves, of course, and a whole lot of people that cohered around them. Ned Kelly's father had been transported to Australia in chains. The family of Joe Byrne, the intellectual, if you like, of the Kelly gang, had been driven out of Ireland by the Irish famine, the genocide by British imperialism of the Irish. And this continuing discrimination in Ireland itself was reinforced in Australia, where, if anything, the Irish were more oppressed than in England. And added to that, there was a long history which these people brought to Australia of rural insurgency in Ireland, of organisations like the Defenders. The main way the Irish peasantry defended itself against the English landlord class was by, killing cattle, burning down their houses, armed secret societies which took their revenge at night. So these traditions were not some alien things. They came to Australia. By the late 1870s, the Kellys were part of the so-called Greta Mob, a group of larrikins. And like Kelly, many of the Greta Mob were of Irish extraction, Australian-born children of Irish parents. Not all by any means, but an important part of it. And who were involved in general altercations with the police, who were in and out of jail, who were stealing horses and cattle. One of the historians gives a good description of them, of these larrikins. Flashy dress, swaggering gait, and riotous behaviour typify the character of the bush larrikin. Gaudy waistcoats, high-heeled boots, and wide-brimmed hats, with the chin strap neatly tucked under the nose, a characteristic destined to become the mark of the Kelly sympathiser. These were the people that supplied information to the Kellys, that cut the telegraph wires, that kept the lookout for police, who provided them with food and weapons and so on, and who, you know, a number of his social historians argue were on the verge of an armed uprising by the time of Glenrowan and the shootout there. Now, the Kelly Gang itself was formed in October 1878, when Ned Kelly took to the hills after his mother had been jailed. And they were then to lead the Police a Merry Dance. And I don't tend to recite all the stories of the highlights of the Kelly Gang, but just named a couple. You know, with the seizing of the town of Euroa and taking it over, then penetrating into New South Wales and their daring raid on the New South Wales town of Jerilderie. And these exploits, in turn, you know, made the police an absolute laughingstock, you know, and that. And both widespread sympathy amongst not just the rural population, but in Melbourne and Geelong. And a sympathy that Kelly very much went out to mobilise and build upon. But every time he robbed a bank, he would burn all the mortgages of the small farmers. The final showdown came at Glenrowan in June 1880, when the gang, backed up by 150 armed sympathisers, took over the town, ripped up the railway track in order to derail a train packed with police, which was heading for them. But the police were tipped off by an informer, a school teacher. Comrades, the school teachers' union's got something to ask for and support. And facing overwhelming numbers, Ned, you know, put on his suit of armour and went out to take on the police single-handedly. You know, and, well, it took dozens of bullets before they brought him down, so they subdued him. Okay, then. Well, how consciously political was Ned Kelly? Now, for some of Kelly's, you know, most avid supporters, he was the archetypal political rebel. You know, a revolutionary whose final showdown at Glenrowan was intended to be the beginning of a rural guerrilla warfare in Victoria to set up a Republic of Northeastern Victoria, to overthrow the British rule, you know, and establish, you know, freedom. And the Kelly Gang clearly were more political than previous bushrangers, and they engaged in more political rhetoric. Their most famous statement, you know, their proclamation, if you like, was the Jerilderie Letter, which was drafted by Joe Byrne. It is a combination of personal justification for their actions, Irish nationalism, scathing attacks on police, and hostility to the squatters and the local establishment and so on. And you get, I won't quote a lot of it, but you get a feel of it from one quote. "Rise, old Erin's Isle, once more from the pressure and tyrannism of the English yoke, which has kept it in poverty and starvation and caused them to wear the enemy's cloak." And so on, you know, with a long, you know, rant against the police, many of whom, of course, were Irish backgrounds themselves, and they were the most hated characters of the lot, the turncoats. Okay, now, however, despite this more political rhetoric, the reality, of course, is the Kelly Gang had no political strategy to offer their supporters and no clear vision of an alternative society, let alone conception of linking up with the growing working class of Melbourne and Geelong to fight to challenge capitalism. Their dreams of a small farmer republic were romantic and impractical in a country which even in the 1880s was overwhelmingly increasingly urbanised. But this, on the other hand, should be no grounds for socialists merely, you know, and simply to dismiss Ned Kelly or downplay his importance as a rebel. I think it's important that socialists claiming for our side. Well, the fact is, the limitations of the Kelly outbreak were inevitable given the social context of the times. There was no developed working class movement in Australia, and that meant then for all Ned Kelly's defiance of authority and fighting spirit and so on, actually, you know, it was impossible in this context for him to, you know, develop a political program and an orientation to take things forward. And that. Now, what exactly motivated Ned Kelly, I think, is going to be forever a source of dispute. We'll never be sure of that. Clearly, a big part of it was resentment with his own social circumstances, the victimization of his own families and so on. Some of it was opportunism, you know, petty criminality, and combined with clearly a genuine concern for his fellow selectors, you know. But the reality is, this series of mixed motives is always intertwined into any rural rebellion. They are never politically pure. However, the other point worth noting, that it wasn't so much Kelly's own actions, but the repressive approach of the police that turned the Kelly phenomena into a mass one and galvanised support for the gang. It was after Kelly himself had been captured and so on in January 1879 that the police began mass arrests of Kelly sympathisers. And for more than 3 months, all the Kelly people, you know, portrayed as being Kelly sympathisers, were held in jail without being brought to trial. And then in July 1879, authorities began to deny land to persons thought to be Kelly sympathisers. And this was a major turning point in terms of broad support for the gang, because this denial of land to the Kelly supporters actually invoked intense memories of evictions by landlords in Ireland. And from this period dates the legends of the Republic of Northeastern Victoria. And it was in this period that the whole oral history about a selector army being formed emerges. And the whole image then created, you know, that the, you know, the Kellys were to be the shock troops, you know, with their armour and so on. They were to be the force in the front line to take on the police, and they would send the signal out to their hundreds of sympathisers to rise. You know, and the whole image of Glenrowan and that, and which the facts are often disputed, but clearly there's something in it. But the idea was that, you know, if they seized Glenrowan, that skyrockets would be sent off, and then, you know, hundreds of other people would be brought in under arms. They'd seize, they'd kill all the police, and they'd kill a few hundred police. They'd seize their arms, and then the guerrilla war would begin. But even after Kelly's hanging, the police were not taking any chances, and that the authorities more broadly. They were very worried that other figures, you know, connected, you know, at some distance from the Kellys, would form a new gang, and the insurgency would continue. So they, you know, used a tense series of repression to eliminate it. The other thing, that's because I've talked about the Irish connection, but I think it's worth emphasising that the support for the Kellys, even early on, broadened out beyond just the Irish connection. It was clearly in the rural areas, and that there were broad support from them amongst all the rural poor, both Catholic and Protestant, and quite significantly as well in the sense that Kelly's played as being some sort of Australian nationalist patriot. There's also considerable considerable sympathy amongst the Chinese population to the Kelly gang. Joe Byrne himself spoke Mandarin, and that a lot of their arms and that were captured by that. And famously, after Kelly had been captured and brought down to Melbourne, one of these guards imprisoning him said, you know, attack the Chinese. And Kelly responded by, I'd rather be a Chinaman than a cop. And that. So the image that often portrayed, you know, that, you know, Kelly fits into the nationalist Australian image, the white Australian policy and so on, I think is all historically dubious. But it wasn't just the rural poor that backed Kelly. There was widespread sympathy for the gang in Melbourne and Geelong amongst the urban working class, where there was broader social ferment as well. at the time of the lead up to the execution, and I'll say a bit more about it on the history tour tomorrow night. I mean, because the person that hung Ned Kelly, sentenced him, was Reuben Barry, who was the first chancellor of this university, which the largest building on the university is named after. At the time of that, actually, we saw mass demonstrations against the execution in Melbourne. A demonstration, the largest, about 8,000 at the time, which is quite big given the population of Melbourne at the time. Okay. But almost immediately after Kelly's execution, the actual historical figure of Ned Kelly gets transformed, in many ways overwhelmed by the myth. There was a whole series of songs and stage plays and dramas and that, centered around the legend. You know, Ned Kelly's sister, one of his surviving sisters, Kate Kelly, for years and years afterwards had this travelling theatre production, which you'd go in around on sort of, you know, a covered wagon, going around all over parts of Australia, you know, with the reenacting the Kelly's Last Stand and that. And the authorities were extremely worried about this. All stage plays and films about Ned Kelly were made illegal. And because the authorities felt that the Kelly legend would be infused into the growing working class movement and establish a tradition in the working class movement of resort to armed struggle. Of course, at a later stage, the authorities attempted different strategies of trying to co-opt, the image of Kelly. But as I said earlier, they had great difficulty doing this. Even though the myth tried to incorporate into Australian nationalism and so on, but really, you know, there's not many good, respectable citizens that really want to have the likes of, Ned Kelly at their barbecue on Australia Day. now, the attempt to, of course, to transform rebels into, co-opted figures, it's nothing new. I mean, the bourgeoisie, always attempts to do this after leading social rebels have died, so they attempt to turn, Karl Marx into somebody that was, really nice, their historical thinker, would spend all his time in the library and so on. This pattern is common. Now, to the extent that they could do it a bit around the Kellys, of course, the fact that they didn't have this clear social program made it a bit easier. But, as I said, that was hardly Kelly's fault. To establish such a program in Northeast Victoria in the 1870s, I don't think was possible. But nevertheless, the legend has to survive because it appeals to genuine sentiments of rebellion. And that explains the continuing ambiguity of the Australian ruling class of the Kelly Ned legend. You know, one level they like to cash in on it, making him a tourist figure and so on. And the display down at the old Melbourne jail is Melbourne's leading tourist attraction and that. So one level. But on the other hand, well, they repress it. And the police, of course, are the most, strident carriers of the idea that, this person is a thief, a murderer, and so on and that. And that is still, in authority, still has a deep root in society. I mean, most people probably don't know this, but it is illegal still in New South Wales to name a child Ned Kelly. It is a criminal offence to name a child Ned Kelly in New South Wales. It is deemed offensive. Well, clearly it is offensive to some people, and should be. There was outrage by a respectable opinion at the big sales of Peter Carey's book, The True History of the Kelly Gang, which was a very sympathetic portrayal of Kelly. And they're worried about the fact, for example, a few years back, when it had more left-wing leadership, the Manufacturing Workers' Union in Victoria, which had incorporated the Metal Workers' Union, used the symbol of Kelly as a metal worker, you know, suit of armour, on their union banners and that. And that never went down too well with the bosses. Now, okay, I should wind up. Well, for socialists today, our emphasis clearly is on open politics for collective working class action. You know, we're not out there welding suits of armour and that. We're trying to build a political alternative to the betrayals of the Labour Party. But I think at the same time, we do want to take inspiration from those before us in history who have stood up and fought back in desperate circumstances. In circumstances, in some senses, which there was no prospect of victory, no prospect of breaking through. But those people who defied and stood up in those circumstances go down in history and should be claimed for our side. And I think the cry of the bushrangers of fight but not surrender is a motto for our times. And I'll leave it there.